Hello and welcome to Virtues of Peace. My name is Hope Elizabeth May, and I'm joined by Michael Buzzy, Randy Olson, and once again, a very special guest, Sandra Weber, who is the author of this wonderful book, The Woman Suffrage Statue, A History of Adelaide Johnson's Portrait Monument at the United States Capitol. This is part two of a two and maybe three-part conversation that we're having with Sandra, because today actually is February 15th, and it is Susan B. Anthony's birthday, 201st birthday, and it's also on this day, 100 years ago, that this statue that we've been talking about, and about which Sandra is the foremost expert, was unveiled in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol. So we have been here talking about the artist a little bit last time, as well as Sandra's research going into various archives in Washington, D.C. And we ended our discussion last time with an account of how Adelaide Johnson came to sculpt the three persons who are memorialized in the portrait monument. That would be Lucretia Mott, Susan B. Anthony, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And what we talked about last time was really this encounter with Susan B. Anthony that Adelaide Johnson has that leads to these different busts that are made for the 1893 World's Fair. And so this statue, as I said, was unveiled in 1921. So that's quite a time span from 1893 to 1921. So this is a process of evolution. We hope to get the story out. And so we're going to pick it up at that moment, Sandra, where you talked about how Susan B. Anthony sits for Adelaide Johnson. And can you just bring us back up to speed with that story? And then I think there are some mishaps there that we didn't talk about. And if you could fill us in with that, that would start the conversation.
Absolutely. So after Adelaide Johnson finally has a satisfactory model made of Susan B. Anthony, that Susan B. Anthony thinks it's a wonderful bust of her, but she says, I can't have this bust of me go to the World's Fair without Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And so Adelaide Johnson pursues a sitting with Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and that happens. And now we have the two model portrait busts of Anthony and Stanton. And now Anthony looks at those and says, those are marvelous, but we can't go to the World's Fair without Lucretia Mott. She's the mother of us all. And so Adelaide Johnson, from photographs, is able to make a model of Lucretia Mott. And so now Adelaide Johnson's going to go to Rome to put those three busts into marble so that they can go to the World's Fair. And when she arrives in Rome, she sees the number 13. Four different times, including the number on her studio. And Adelaide Johnson's a very superstitious person. And so she foresees this as doom, that she doesn't know how she's going to get through this. And doom does pursue her. She's working on the Susan B. Anthony bust in her studio, and she goes out for lunch, and she comes back, and there is Susan B. Anthony's bust laying on the floor. And Adelaide Johnson's just devastated. She's sure that it's ruined. But another sculptress comes in and says, now let's, you know, look at it. And then they pick it up. And sure enough, nothing really important has been destroyed. And she's able to work with that model and continue it. Now, they almost have that model done in marble. And Harriet Hosmer, probably the foremost woman sculptress at the time, comes to Johnson's studio and takes a look at the model and suggests that if the hair were done a little differently, the hair could look thicker and better. And of course, once that suggestion has been made, Adelaide Johnson cannot go forward without taking that suggestion. So she throws out that marble and starts a new marble of Susan B. Anthony. They're working on that second marble, and then a soft spot is discovered in the marble, and it's right in the face of Susan B. Anthony, and they have to throw out that marble and start over again. During all of this, the person working on Lucretia Mott's marble also discovers a flaw in the marble, and that one has to be thrown out. So there are many, many mishaps that occur as she's trying to put these busts into marble. But she completes them. They're ready ahead of time. They're ready to be shipped to Chicago for the World's Fair. And somehow the date gets changed of the ship that's coming to take all of the artwork to the fair. And Adelaide Johnson's art does not make it to the fair. So now she has to pay for special shipping for her bus to come to the fair in Chicago. And they're late. The fair's already open. And she's rushing to get them displayed in the women's building. And along with the marbles, she has made three marble pedestals for the three busts. But she has made those for herself, for her own use. And she doesn't want those pedestals used and marked up at the fair. She wants the marble busts just put on the regular wooden pedestals like everyone else's artwork. Well, the fair administrators are having a fit about this, and they want to use her pedestals, and she gets into a fight with it, and she says, I'm just going to take my artwork and put it in the other building, put it in the art building where there are women and men artwork. And so she's rushing to the administration building to complain about this and get this done, and she's walking across the floor without paying attention, and she falls through the floor where there's a tile missing. And she hurts her leg. So another fall, like the elevator flaw. And again, in this case, after she has that accident, her pedestals are set aside for her. Her busts are placed in the most prominent place in the women's building, in the gallery of honor there. And so she has the best place in all of the fair, really, to display her models, and everyone loves them.
I mean, I use this phrase sometimes, the ordinary in the extraordinary, and these little details. And this is why I love your book so much, that you have all of these little details about, the reality of getting these busts to the United States, getting them in the room. Like, this is not so easy to do all of the time. And so we're going to see that Adelaide Johnson, just keeps encountering these obstacles all the way up and even after the unveiling in 1921. And it's one of the reasons why she's such a great character, because she models one of the cardinal virtues, which is known as fortitude. Anybody else want to add to that, the sort of account of how difficult it is for her to just get these things into the World's Fair?
Aside from just the sheer difficulty of like creating such a thing and then transporting it, period, right? I think that just we can all imagine how difficult it is to put together something that accurately represents people whose stature is like towering above generations. And so to capture that in the first place is monumental. And then, the physical transport of something enormous, I think speaks, it's difficult enough to imagine. So let alone the political side of it. I think that's all.
And just to be clear, that when she's we're not even talking about the hulking statue that was unveiled in 1921, which is, I think like 7 tons or something. We're just talking about three individual busts that she makes for the World's Fair. And so even that, even though it's not as big, there are still these difficulties. And I think it's on page 36 of your book, Sandra, that you have a photograph of these busts in the center of the Gallery of Honor. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so again, this is 1893. So it's another 28-year journey from these three individual busts to the portrait monument, which is a single statue of all three. So we will then, I don't want to go immediately to 1921, but is there anything like what happens to the statues after the fair? Where do they go?
Yes, I want to talk about that. I want to comment on the comment that was made that, yeah, it's amazing to me. This is kind of a prelude of all of her troubles that she has just with the three busts. And you made the great point. This isn't the larger 7.5-ton monument, but this is the trouble she has just in sculpting three individual busts. And she has all these problems with flaws in the marbles and with transporting just three busts. And so how does she have the audacity, right, to think that in 1921 she's gonna make this enormous, right, monument, and that shipping isn't going to be a problem, and that there's not going to be a flaw in this huge piece of marble? So I think this World Fair thing is somewhat of a foreshadowing of what's to come.
Yeah, and I'll just plant the seed now. We'll talk about it later, but you know, your claim, how does she have the audacity to think she can make this 7.5? And the thing is, when she goes to Italy, that's not her plan, right?
Right.
That like evolves when she's over there. So when she goes over there, like, I think the agreement is she's going to make just, you know, copies of these busts that she's familiar with.
And yes.
Three busts are going to go on a single pedestal, but it's just going to be three busts on a single pedestal. But what happens, you know, when she's over there in Italy is something happens and she changes the design and just P.S. So, like, I don't know what happens to her over there, but it's like now's the time or something, like it's now or never. So what happens after the fair? I mean.
Oh, yes. Okay. So. The three busts, there's been a contract made with three women to produce these busts, and the plan is they're intended to go into the Capitol. And so as a fulfillment of the agreement, the busts have to go into the Capitol, and then she will get her final payment. Well, the likelihood of these three busts going into the Capitol in 1893, as you can guess, is just, you know, impossible. And no one really even tries to make that happen. But the National American Women's Suffrage Association kind of believes that they have ownership of these busts because it was three women from Nassau that made this contract. But it turns out that, you know, Adelie doesn't read the contract that way, that she reads that she put in the contract that she has, you know, custodianship of these busts until they go into the Capitol. And so even though Susan B. Anthony decides that she doesn't really want them to go into the Capitol anymore, because she sees the Capitol as a place where, you know, men are smoking cigars and swearing and drinking and, you know, all this bad stuff is going on in the Capitol, she decides she wants them to go into the Library of Congress building. And Adelie Johnson, of course, doesn't want to go along with that plan because they have to go in the Capitol. So she holds on to them. She sometimes displays them at some Nassau meetings, at the Corcoran Gallery, et cetera, et cetera. And something important though happens in 1909. And that is that Alva Vanderbilt Belmont, who's a multimillionaire, comes along and visits Adelie Johnson's studio, sees the bus, and decides that she wants a copy of those three busts. And so she buys a copy of those original 1892 model busts, and she puts them in her house in Manhattan. And so this begins a relationship between Alva Belmont and Adelie Johnson that will last for a long time. And as we'll get into, there's a new group of suffragists that come along that eventually form the National Women's Party. And Belmont becomes kind of their benefactor. She supports them now, giving them money for buildings, et cetera. And she supports Adelie Johnson and is the major funder of what will become the Portrait Monument. So this meeting of Belmont and Johnson is very important.
Hmm. Okay, so Alva Belmont has her own statues in her house. So just, I think some of our listeners aren't so versed on women's history. And just to, again, make it really clear, you mentioned NASA, the National American Woman Suffrage Association, the older organization, and then something called the National Woman's Party, which is formed, I think its official formation date is 1916, although Alice Paul starts to do her stuff in DC in 1913. Mm-hmm. So she's like younger generation. She's trained by the British suffragettes.
Yes.
not suffragists. I mean, you know, Sandra, that this is something that even our most, you know, senior political officials will confuse these terms, but suffragettes is the sort of pejorative term that was used by the British press to talk about the British women fighting for the right to vote, and suffragist is the U.S. branch, and they had tactically different approaches. But in any case, Alice Paul comes, and she's younger, and she organizes this National Woman's Party, and as you said, Alva Belmont really was like the bankroller of that, of the National Woman's Party. When I went to the Sewell Belmont house, the way that Alva Belmont was, and you see that's her name, Belmont, Sewell Belmont, and now it's the Belmont Paul Women's Equality National Monument. So that's Alva Belmont and Alice Paul. They described her as, she married a Vanderbilt, divorced a Vanderbilt, and then married his best friend.
Yes.
So she had a lot of money, and she spent it on votes for women.
Yes.
So
I just have to jump in. She also made divorce acceptable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She's a really great character. And I really didn't know about her until I visited the what was then called the Sewell Belmont House. And she's since become a favorite person of mine. So Alva Belmont, look her up. She's awesome. So she has these busts, and we get up to, we're skipping through a lot of history, but we're getting up to the 19th Amendment that is officially ratified on August 26th, 1920. And as I think we said last time, the whole reason why this statue is commissioned by the National Woman's Party is to like mark the moment of the 19th Amendment, and like put something in the Capitol. So there are some sort of tensions between this older National American Woman Suffrage Association, NASA, and the National Woman's Party, this younger Alice Paul led entity. There's a little brouhaha, no, about like who should have the credit for getting the 19th Amendment ratified.
Yes, and that, you know, they both think, oh, you know, we need to have a statue of some kind, you know, that's gonna mark this, it's gonna symbolize this great suffrage victory. And of course, NASA is the much older organization formed by Stanton and Anthony that's been around for a long time, much bigger than the newly formed National Women's Party. And this conflict between Adlai Johnson and the National Suffrage Party has been going on for many, many years. And it really came to a head in about 1909 when Adlai Johnson just was done fighting over, you know, what should be done with these busts and who owned them. And she really just withdrew from NASA altogether. So she put the busts in storage, and she writes this 64-page letter about why she's, you know, disgusted with all of this. And she writes that letter to her friend, Ida Harper. Now, Ida Harper is very involved with NASA. She is the woman who, you may recall her name, is on some of the volumes of the History of Women's Suffrage written by Anthony and Stanton. Ida Harper helped them go through all of their notes and things and write the History of Women's Suffrage volumes. But she's also a good friend with Adlai Johnson. So Ida Harper's kind of trying to negotiate, you know, what's going to happen with these busts now that it looks like suffrage is going to pass. So a few years earlier, Ida Harper actually had gotten the final living person who had made this commitment to funding these busts, Jean Greenleaf from Rochester. And she has signed over power of attorney for this bust fund contract. She has signed over power of attorney to Ida Harper. So Ida Harper can now negotiate, you know, where these busts are going to go. And she gets Adlai Johnson to agree in 1918 to hand them over to Nassau and that Nassau will put them in the Capitol to celebrate the suffrage celebration. However, Harper cannot get the agreement of Carrie Chapman Catt and Anna Howard Shaw, who are really the power players of Nassau now that Anthony's gone. And Carrie Chapman Catt never liked these busts from the very beginning. And so Catt refuses to have anything to do with the bust, doesn't want to be involved with putting them in the Capitol or anything. And so Ida Harper says, well, then I'm want them, you know, to be placed in the Capitol. So I'm going to work with the National Women's Party. And, you know, Nassau just says, okay, go ahead. And so that's kind of how this all begins. And Alice Paul is interested in putting the bus in the Capitol. They have seen the bus at Alva Belmont's house. And they think, well, this would be a great thing to do to celebrate the 19th Amendment. And so they invite Adlai Johnson to come to the Women's Party headquarters. And they tell her that, you know, they're interested in doing this. And Adlai Johnson is just stunned. You know, finally, after all these years, someone is actually interested in putting these busts in the Capitol. But in her elation, she takes a moment and she thinks and she says, you know what, though? You know, I was very young when I made those busts. I could do much better now. How about if you give me a commission for $2,000 and I go back over to Europe and I make new models and I make new marbles to put into the Capitol? And Alice Paul bites and she says, okay, that sounds great. And so Adlai Johnson, now she's like 61 years old at this point, but she must be thinking, oh my gosh, you know, this is finally going to happen. So she immediately gets a ticket to sail to Europe. Now, okay, that's wonderful. But think again, this audacity, this is just to make the three busts, right? But the suffrage amendment hasn't been ratified yet. There's no guarantee that they're ever going to get into the Capitol. And she doesn't even have a signed commission from the National Women's Party yet. But she hops on a boat and sails to Europe to make the bus.
Yeah, I love that. And some of us on this show know of a principal from Stephen Pressfield and his book, Do the Work, Start Before You're Ready.
Yes.
And it's just, yeah, I love this part of the story where she's just going for it. I mean, and I love that. That's just this, the fierce urgency of now. It's start before you're ready. It's now's the time. Now's the moment. And if I don't do it, no one will, kind of thing. And I just, yeah, I just think that's delightful. Anybody yes. else want to jump in on that point?
I would like to ask a question, and it's kind of a scope question, like a zoom out, like step back for a second and ask about the role that like physical, tangible objects, like what role they have in, you know, the cultivation of memory or the transfer of a story or an idea or like as a symbol, because, you know, we're talking about these statues and I'm really interested in Sandra's opinion about like what role this kind of art has, so that, you know, because I don't know, I really like those kinds of grand narratives to kind of plug all this information into.
Yes. So she plans for these to go into the rotunda of the Capitol, right? And she's actually gone with Alice Paul before she sails to Europe to say, well, where in the Capitol should they go? And she doesn't like Statuary Hall and whatever. She picks out the rotunda, right? And she specifically wants these busts to go into the rotunda and specifically to stand across the rotunda from Gustav Borglum's big head of Abraham Lincoln. I don't know if you recall this. It's just this enormous bust of Abraham Lincoln by Borglum. And it was sitting in the rotunda at that time. And she sees that and she says, my artwork has to go in the rotunda opposite this piece of artwork. Now, getting back to answer your question, in that the Capitol Rotunda is, in a sense, the National Museum of our country. So she sees this as the highest place in the country for a piece of artwork to stand. And that the fact that there are no women standing in that room, real women standing, you know, no representation of real women in that room, that this is vitally important to the government's recognition that women actually exist, right? That women have a history in this country, that women are part of the history, right? Are part of the government, that are human beings, that are a part of, you know, what our country is about. That's the significance to her, and to have this physical representation of real women in this most important museum in our nation. I don't know if that's getting at what you were looking for.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'll just plant the seed now, but you know, what you just said, Sandra, that like the rotunda, I think you said it's like the National Museum of our country for this reason, as we'll get to later, but I just want to plant the seed now. The statue has been criticized by African-American women, that there is no African-American woman. Last I checked in the rotunda, and then the statue needs to be changed to put, so we'll get there later, but yeah, that's part of their critique, that this is such a sacred space, and therefore there needs to be like a more complete view of history, not only with women, but you know, women of color working for suffrage. So we'll get to that later. But any other, Michael, do you have a?
Yes, go ahead. I thought the connection to Stephen Pressfield's amazing 2011 work, Do the Work, is very applicable to Adelaide Johnson's story and getting these busts created, because he describes in his book that in any creative endeavor in which you try to infuse something new into the world, there always arises a resistive force to try to undercut and impede you from being able to achieve the end of that creative goal. And I think, Sandra, from you just talking about all of Adelaide Johnson's physical injuries, all the political and other forces that arise to prevent her from doing the work, the softness in marble that prevents certain pieces from being used, and just how many renditions she had to go through to actually get to the place in which she does, but yet she persists. And he calls that stubbornness of it can't, he does not like, you know, resiliency, that it's stubborn, that, you know, you're getting down in the dirt and you're going to fight against and fight on to continue to inject your work into the world. And I think that's very applicable to this truly amazing work of moral energy.
Thank you. And yes, we're going to see that. I'm glad you brought up that idea of whenever you try to do something new, you're going to get resistance. And that's what we're going to see, right? When she finally decides to merge all of these pieces together, this is something unconventional. This is something new. And people are resistant to something new.
The I maybe Stephen Pressfield, but I think it's not. But there's this phrase, the magnetic pull of the status quo. Like this is part of the resistance, that the status quo is a tyrant and it wants to stay, and it will fight like heck to prevent the new thing from coming in. So Adelaide Johnson is like, wow, the National Women's Party, they're like, Alice Paul is biting, and I'm going to go to Italy and I'm going to sculpt these three busts in marble. Yeah. with my, you know, more mature skill. And I think this is amazing. And again, like in your book, which is linked on our show resources page at virtuesofpeace.com, you point out that she set sail on the SS President Wilson. Which is, you know, beautifully ironic. Can you explain why that's funny?
Yes, because, you know, the suffragists had been battling President Wilson for years because he opposed the support of a federal suffrage amendment. He kept telling them, oh, just, you know, you got to go, you know, do it state by state. And, you know, oh, I agree with what you're doing, but I can't support a federal amendment. I can't do that. So, you know, he's been the resistance of them for many, many years. And so here she is sailing on the President Wilson to create this monument to, in part of its sense, at least, to the celebration of suffrage.
Yeah. So she goes over there in May 1920. And as we said earlier, something happens and she scraps this original plan. So can you talk about what happens?
Yeah. So she gets to Rome and she makes new models of the bus. Now, I don't know if I really explained, you know, what I'm saying by models versus the marble bus. But so first she's sculpting these new models in clay. And so she's made, I don't know, 8 or 9 different versions, right, of the Anthony bust and a couple of the other ones. Well, now she makes even newer models that are in a sense, you know, even more idealized versions. And for example, like she takes the, Lucretia Mott has the little Quaker bonnet on, and Ellie Johnson removes the bow of the tie of the bonnet from this new model. And, you know, again, like with Susan B. Anthony's glasses, we don't miss that bow because somehow she's captured the essence of it. So she makes these new models and she's going to put them in this triangle formation on top of the pedestal. And she's going to make this ornate pedestal, which she actually draws a little sketch for. But somehow she looks at this and just says, you know, this isn't going to cut it for me. I'm going to merge these three busts and the pedestal all into one magnificent monument. It's just going to be this incredible, awesome monument now, not bus, but a monument. Now, there's, I think, several things that came together that made her realize that this was the thing to do. One, we talked a little bit last time about how she has come to see these three busts as a unit, that one of these people could have not done their work without the others. And that this is, in a sense, a trinity to her. These three have to be together. And she doesn't ever want to see these three separated. And we can't talk about everything here, but there have been attempts to, for example, throw out Elizabeth Cady Stanton from the Great Three, or to replace Mott with somebody else. And so she's really afraid that these three are going to get separated. And she realizes that if she merges them all into one piece of marble, no one can ever separate these three. The last thing that I think comes together for her, as I was talking about, she's gone to the rotunda. She's said, this is where I want this piece of art to stand. She has seen Borglum's big head of Lincoln, and she has seen the other statues in the rotunda and says, you know, these three busts on a pedestal are not going to be up to the stature of the other artwork in the rotunda. I've got to make something that's as grand as the other works of art in the rotunda. And so by merging these all into the portrait monument, instead of having something conventional, like three busts on a pretty pedestal, she's now going to make something that is unconventional that no one's ever done before. And this is going to be her magnificent piece of art. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she kind of overlooks the fact that, right, okay, this is going to end up being 7.5 feet tall and 7+ tons, and that she's going to have to carve this from this huge block of marble, which if there's any flaws in certain places, she's going to have to throw out the whole marble and start from scratch. And of course, this to get this huge block of marble is going to cost her a lot more money, which she doesn't have. And so she has to ask the National Women's Party to double her commission to $4,000. Mm-hmm. And before she even gets permission, she gets she orders the marble. She goes to Carrara, Italy, and starts carving it before she has permission.
Yeah, that's it right there. I just want to like take a zoom lens and focus on that right there. Yeah. That's where it's at.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm looking at page 67 in your book where this episode is discussed, and you quote, I think maybe from her diary, "The swift answer of my soul was it must be done, despite all these uncertainties." The yeah. swift answer of my soul is it must be done. That's it. And so, yeah, she just, again, it's start before you're ready, but it worked out. I mean, they agree. Yes. One thing we talked about last time was the inscription. And I think it was 1917 is when she starts to formulate the inscription that goes on to the 7.5 ton hulking marble that comes back to the US. My understanding, Sandra, is that she didn't really discuss the inscription or mention it. Is that your understanding?
That's yes. She sent it to her brother, and she did send it to Ida Harper, but she was going to send a copy of the inscription to Alice Paul. And then she changed her mind and decided that she didn't want to send it. And I think part of the reason for that is that as she's sculpting the portrait monument, she's getting all of these letters and telegrams from people at the National Women's Party suggesting that she make Elizabeth Cady Stanton a little less fat and make her hair a little different, or to make Susan B. Anthony's chest not so prominent. And she's really fed up with all of these suggestions that she's getting from people, because she's like, I'm the artist, I know what I'm doing. And so I think with the inscription, she probably didn't want to show it to them because she was probably afraid that she would get more suggestions or more demands.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. I leave it open to anybody to follow. Go ahead, Brandy.
Yeah, I'm interested to know, over the process of generating the inscription, I recall last time you mentioned that there was a bunch of changes, modifications made and edits over some period of time to the inscription and the language that was going to be used. But I'm wondering, like, was there any dramatic shift in the meaning across time, as far as your, you know, from what you could find, or was it basically the same idea?
It was basically the same idea that she kept refining, and I don't remember, you know, the specific little words that she changed here and there. I do remember the one line, "Woman first denied a soul, then called mindless, now arisen, declared herself an entity to be reckoned." That she had from the very beginning, I remember. And I just love that line. I really wanted to call the book "An Entity to be Reckoned," because those words, I think, just really say it all. They say it.
I'm pretty sure, like, one of the things that I focus on, as I think everybody on this show knows, and the reason why I'm really interested in the statue is because of the intersection between the peace through law movement and this statue, which we'll talk about later. But one of the earlier drafts of the inscription, it says something like an unprecedented revolution. And that's, she adds, achieving without bloodshed. I'm pretty sure that evolution happens with the inscription. So it's more obvious that it's a nonviolent revolution. So yeah, in the earlier drafts, it's just there, it's just an unprecedented, and then without bloodshed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll talk more about that later. But so the inscription, it was 238 words. Is that right?
I think that's what I counted. It's long.
Yeah. So she wanted to chisel it on the statue. And again, this is just like the story of this is just so human. She doesn't have the time to chisel the inscription on the statue. So she stencils it on the statue in gold. And all we've been talking about is just this journey to this statue, creating it. Now she has to get it from Italy to the United States. And I just find this story is just, and there's pictures that you can Google. I think on our show resources page, we have a link to some of the photographs held by the Library of Congress, which shows her with her team of oxen and so forth. And there's various pictures of the transport of this thing. And can you talk about that, Sandra? This is the transport and the obstacles that she faces in getting the statue from Italy to the United States 100 years ago.
Yes, and I'm going to start with even getting it right to the ship, getting it from her statue to the ship, right? Which really they finished the statue on the day before Christmas and they start building a special shipping crate. Like, this isn't something, right? You can't just order a shipping crate and whatever. They have to build their own shipping crate and pack the monument specially into this. And this process begins the day before Christmas. And on Christmas Day, which of course they don't work on Christmas Day, but she writes a letter and she just says, "From the door of hell, whence I hope to escape." So you get a sense of her mindset at this point of just like, oh, let me get this over with and get back to America. So 2 days after Christmas, they finally get the crate done. And now they have to get it out of the studio. So they have to hook up two oxen with a cart and get this onto this cart and haul the statue out of the studio and then hook up the rest of the oxen. I think there's like eight oxen that have to haul this cart with the big crate on it. And they're hauling it through the town because she has to get it to Genoa, which is where the ship's going to be. Now, to get it to the ship, they first have to haul it on the road to a closer seaport and then by boat to get it to Genoa. So they start hauling it down the road and Allie Johnson doesn't go with it. She stays in the town. She's having a nice lunch. She's, you know, calming down. And all of a sudden she gets word that the road has been closed to heavy traffic due to bad weather conditions and that the portrait monument is sitting in the middle of the road in deep mud. And Adelaide Johnson says, well, at least there's no chance of anyone stealing it. So it's sitting, you know, it's sitting in the mud. Meanwhile, the sea has gotten rough so that this boat is not going to be able to transport it by sea to Genoa. So now she's got to go by railroad. So now at the last minute, she's got to try to make arrangements to have it shipped by railroad. And everyone says, well, that's not going to happen. It's not going to arrive in time. And by the way, there's now a strike going on at Genoa by the workers there. So I don't know how they're going to get it onto the ship. And if you do get it there, the crane probably isn't going to be able to lift 7.5 tons. Oh, and by the way, another earthquake happens while they're waiting to see what's going to happen. There have been earthquakes throughout this entire time that she's making the portrait monument, shaking the ground and the statues shaking. And now here she is. She's finally got it done. And here's another earthquake. But somehow she overcomes all of that. And it is placed on the ship on January 1st, making its way to New York.
And the ship's name is?
The ship's name is Dante Alighieri.
Just, that's too much.
Yes.
And I this is on page 79 of your book. Like, earthquakes, strikes, rough seas. And then the shipper actually says to her, the shipper says, chances 99 out of 100 against you.
Yes.
That doesn't stop her though, does it?
No, it doesn't.
All right, so it gets on the ship. Nor are the difficulties over. So they arrive in the United States on, I think, January 20th, 1921. And then they arrive in New York, correct?
Yes.
And then they have to get on a train to go to DC.
Yes.
So tell us about what happens then.
Well, from the train, it has to, somehow it ends up being on a horse-drawn cart to actually get to the Capitol itself. And no one's sitting there at the Capitol waiting for it, right? As a matter of fact, what's happened is Alice Paul and the National Women's Party have not gotten permission to have it placed in the Capitol yet. Mm-hmm. So this is February 4th, right? And February 15th is supposed to be the celebration. Mm-hmm. And so far, the Joint Committee on the Library, who has been tasked with deciding whether to accept this statue or not, has so far decided not to accept it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think that, I mean, Alice Paul sort of doesn't reveal that information to Adelaide Johnson, just as Adelaide Johnson doesn't reveal the inscription. So there's a little bit of, I don't think it's a good idea to tell this so I can achieve my objective. I mean, in the end, so it does finally get into the Capitol. And I think it was, on February 11th. And that's when we did our last show, last Thursday on February 11th. That's the day that it actually like enters the Capitol grounds. And that's just, 4 days before. So what's happening with the Joint Committee on the Library? Like, why can't they just decide to let the statue in?
Well, they decide that it's ugly, that it's artless, that it looks like three ladies in a bathtub, that it's too heavy for the rotunda floor. They have all kinds of excuses. Such as this. And I do have to say there's one thing that I think that happened that helped prejudice their ideas against it ahead of time. And that's back to this, Adelaide Johnson and Alice Paul each kind of doing their own thing. And Alice Paul insists that Adelaide Johnson send her photographs of the monument in progress. And so Adelaide Johnson sends those, but she says, don't really show these to anybody because you can't really imagine what this is going to look like till you see the finished piece of art. But these photos of the monument in progress get shown, and I think they even get leaked out to the press. And these photographs of the early progress, it's like, you know, the tips of their heads like coming out of this big blob of marble. And it obviously is not flattering and does not in any way indicate what the finished piece is going to look like. And so I think, you know, there's sort of some prejudice that's already developed, regardless of the fact, as Ellie Johnson puts it, these men really don't want any women in the Capitol, real women or marble women.
And there are some anti-suffragists on the committee, no?
Yes. Yes, mm-hmm. There definitely are some anti-suffragists, and they're just really not wanting to accept this piece of art. And, you know, whether their, you know, feelings are genuine or not, you know, I can't say. You know, I can only look at what happened. So this, do you want me to get this, does get resolved though, mm-hmm. right? They do make it into the Capitol. So what happens? Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that surprised me is I discovered that Carrie Chapman Catt, of course, through all of this, opposes the bus being put into the Capitol. And this gets out that she doesn't want the bus to be accepted. And when the congressmen who are on the committee of acceptance hear that Carrie Chapman Catt opposes the bus, they're like, this was our like main opponent in the suffrage battle for the amendment. And so if she doesn't want these accepted, you know what? I think we should accept them. And suddenly they turn around and they accept the monuments into the Capitol.
Amazing.
It's very strange, very strange outcome.
And they agree, I think it's February 10th, where they finally agree to like let the statue into the Capitol, and it will go into the rotunda, but only for a ceremony. And then it will be moved someplace. Is that the sort of resolution that they come up with?
That's right. But once again, Alice Paul and some of the leaders of the National Women Party make this agreement, but they don't tell anyone. And most of all, they don't tell Adlai Johnson.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anybody want to jump in? Nope. Okay. So, yeah, they're not telling Adlai Johnson everything. The obstacles, as we said in the beginning, that she faces don't stop even after the unveiling.
Yes.
And so there is this agreement. They don't tell her. And so she expects that her statue is going to stay in the rotunda, I mean, in perpetuity, I guess. Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And she's shocked the next day when she goes to the Capitol and sees that it's been removed from the rotunda, taken back outside again, and then brought mm-hmm. back in to the lower floor.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing they do, which is I'm sure extremely painful, is when they have the ceremony, they cover up the inscription, or what happens with that?
Yes, they're forced to put a yellow cloth over the back of it to cover up the inscription.
Okay, so let's just talk a little bit about the actual beautiful ceremony of the unveiling. That's 100 years ago on this day. And the person who presided over the ceremony is Jane Addams, who would later in 1931 go on to win the Nobel Peace Prize, the first American woman to do so. And Sarah Bard Field gives a speech, and you can access both of their remarks, Jane Addams and Sarah Bard Field's remarks at the unveiling, at our show resources page, virtuesofpeace.com. And Sandra, can you, do you have a sense of like why they were chosen? Or because it's for me, they're both Jane Addams and Sarah Bard Field were known peace workers. Sarah Bard Field is working on behalf of conscientious objectors. She was a member of the American Peace Party. There's various, you know, quotes where she says this is the most important thing to her is peace, and she breaks with the National Woman's Party because that wasn't, they weren't focused on that. They were focused more on suffrage. So I think it's very striking that these two are chosen to preside over this. And, you know, World War One has just ended, Treaty of Versailles. This is 1921. And so sort of like war and conscription and that kind of thing is like on people's minds. What do you think, Sandra?
I'm not really sure why they were chosen. I did not find really much explanation for that. I think they both were maybe on the advisory council of the National Women's Party. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, but I do think that there were many people who anticipated that after this celebration, that the National Women's Party was going to take up a platform of peace, and that was going to be their new, you know, rather, you know, suffrage was over with, and that now their platform would be a peace platform. But that's not what happened. They took up the Equal Rights Amendment and the idea of equality. So perhaps there was that anticipation. I don't really know, but mm-hmm. but what I do see is that in both of their speeches, they really understood what Adlai Johnson was trying to say with this monument, that it wasn't just about suffrage, and that this isn't just a chunk of marble sitting here, but this is a living, breathing monument for our living, breathing, evolving movement that is going to continue. We're not done here.
Right, and you can access those speeches again at our show resources page. And so, yeah, do check those out. And there are a few pictures that you can see. If you, you know, go to Google, you can see pictures of the ceremony. You can see several pictures of Jane Addams in front of the statue, not only in the rotunda, but when it's outside in a crate.
Yes.
Yes. So those are, yeah, wonderful pictures. So she's sort of there from the beginning, Jane Addams, with this journey of the statue into the Capitol. But on the 16th, the day after, as we said, the statue is removed from the rotunda. And as you said, Sandra, like Adlai Johnson sculpts this to go into the rotunda, right?
Yes.
It's moved to the crypt. Why does this happen?
Well, as we said, I think I said earlier, you know, it actually had been agreed to by Alice Paul. And I mean, part of the reason was it was said that the rotunda floor could not support this monument. And so during the celebration, they had put these like long supports underneath it to kind of spread out the weight. And it wasn't, also, I might say, it wasn't just the statue that Adlai Johnson had also put a base underneath it. And in 1925, she actually added a second base underneath it. So there was additional weight besides the weight of the statue. There was the weight of these bases. But Alice Paul thought that the crypt was just a lovely place, and that it was actually absolutely fine that that's where it went, at least temporarily, until Congress could decide where to put it permanently. You know, again, back, you know, Alice Paul was more concerned with politics and the being able to hold her celebration, and that the monument being there during the celebration And I just, you know, politically, I'm not sure it was that important to her what, you know, what really happened afterwards. Where as for Adlai Johnson, you know, the whole thing was about it, you know, being in the rotunda.
And there was, I think I recall, you know, from your book, and there was some press at the time, which like didn't really, it didn't reveal that this is something that Alice Paul agreed to. And it sort of portrayed this moment as this is a sign of disrespect to put the women in the basement, so to speak.
Absolutely. So much of this part of the story, I think, has been exaggerated or kind of spun to a different, implying something different, that it was the congressman who did this, that it was the architect of the Capitol that did this or something. And also that I think the idea of the crypt was really overplayed at the time too. You know, to this day, it still says, you know, the statue was put in a broom closet. Okay, like that's physically just not possible. Or in replying, saying that it was placed in the basement. Mm. Now, the Capitol, I mean, I suppose you could think of that as the basement, perhaps, but it's not generally called that. It really is the first floor of the Capitol. So, you know, there's a little spin on that. Mm-hmm. And the crypt is directly under the rotunda, under the dome. And there were people going through that, you know, tour groups went through the crypt and senators and representatives went through the crypt to get back and forth to the different houses and chambers. Obviously, it wasn't where any other artwork was. So it wasn't, you know, a pretty place. It wasn't a place where art was normally placed.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, yeah, as you say, this is sort of like played up, this humiliation of it being lowered. And I really want you to share, as you know, Sandra, because we've talked about this, and you can access on our Shoe Resources page, Tales from the Crypt, the Volunteer Scrubwoman's Brigade. And so this is one of my favorite stories. I can't get over it. It always makes me laugh. Just tell that story, please.
Okay. Well, basically the monument went into the basement, and it was kind of pushed against the wall with the inscription to the wall, so you couldn't read the inscription. But also, as I was saying, there's no other pieces of art there. So no one was really cleaning the statue or, you know, dusting it. And, you know, it was just sitting there for months. And eventually some women from the National Women's Party, you know, said, you know, ask for it to be cleaned. And they sent a couple of letters, I think, and they were ignored. And so they just said, we're going to go over and clean it ourselves. There's dust encrusted on the face of, you know, Susan B. Anthony, and we're going to go clean it. And so their headquarters was just kind of across the street from the Capitol. And so they got some buckets and some scrub brushes, and they went over and started scrubbing it and cleaning the statue.
And they made a press event out of it.
Absolutely, yes. There are great pictures of them carrying their buckets across the street, and little cartoons were made of, you know, someone on top of the, you know, scrubbing the faces with their brushes. And yes, the media loved that story.
Yes. And in your book, this is on page 108, you say a group of women from the National Woman's Party requested a cleaning cloth from the architect of the Capitol, but there was not a dust cloth to be found anywhere in the Capitol. Yes. So they went to the National Women's Party headquarters across the street and gathered supplies. And so, yeah, there's national press on this, quote, scrub women's brigade. And I just think that's a delightful story. Now, we want to fast forward. Well, actually, there's one thing we didn't talk about. I mean, we mentioned the inscription that it's covered up, pushed against the wall in the crypt. And
yes,
there's a drape over it for the ceremony on February 15th. But but eventually what happens to that inscription?
Well, when the scrub women come over, they also make the point that, you know, we want this statue moved and we want it placed in the middle of the crypt in a more prominent position, at least, you know, with it in the middle of the crypt with these grand pillars around it, you know, it will look significant and important. And I think perhaps the publicity from that, next thing you know, about a month or so later, the monument is moved away from the wall and placed in the middle of the crypt. And it looks beautiful there. And Adelaide Johnson is living in New York City at the time. She comes down and she goes and she looks at it and she walks around to the side of it and says, "Oh my gosh, the inscription is gone. The inscription has been removed." And to her, this has just, you know, destroyed the whole meaning of the monument because she had put that in her inscription. And she is very, very upset about this and goes to Alice Paul. And again, Alice Paul's reaction is kind of that, I don't know if she comes right out and says this, I can't quite remember, but basically that she has agreed that the inscription could be removed. And now that the inscription is removed, we can get the statue put wherever we want. And, you know, maybe we like it here in the crypt, in the middle of the crypt, and maybe it should stay there. Or now maybe we can have it moved to the rotunda because it doesn't have the inscription on it anymore.
And to this day, it doesn't have the inscription on it, as we said last week. But that inscription is in your book, and I think it's in our show resources from last week. There's a newspaper article that has some version of the inscription on it that you can read. And so it stays in the crypt for a really long time.
Yes.
And I've been doing my research on this part of the story. So there's a movement to raise it from the crypt back to the rotunda that really begins. It really begins, as I understand it now, I keep learning, in the late 70s. And Caroline Sparks, I believe you have, you know, some references to some of her speeches, and she's in the Congressional Record in 1995. She also, yeah, stumbles upon the statue, and she's relayed to me that she does that when she's in Washington, D.C. for some sort of a rally, a woman's event, and she needs to find a bathroom, and she goes into the Capitol, and she goes into the crypt, and she sees this statue, and she recognizes who they are, and that begins her push to get it back into the rotunda. And she says, it doesn't belong down here. And she sort of, this is in like the late 70s, and she is imagining that the 75th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, which is 1995.
I think so.
Yeah, like that's the day, to shoot for. So this is in this late 70s, she stumbled upon the statue,
right?
So like the moment to like let's have it raised by the 75th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, which is 1995. So you see some legislative activity going on in 1995, because again, this is the 75th anniversary of the 19th Amendment. And I'm going to play an audio clip. This is actually a sort of like montage of both some remarks about the statue in the House and then also in the Senate. Again, the year is 1995, and this is about a 3-minute clip.
I thank the chair, and I take the floor to talk about some interesting things that symbolize what is happening in the political debate in this House. Last week, we saw a real brouhaha on this floor about something I never thought we would see a brouhaha over. There are three women in the basement of this building that represent the suffragettes. And when that statute was done, they were supposed to bring that statue and put it in the rotunda. As you know, the statue was done many, many years ago, but they never put it in the rotunda. They've kept it in the basement. Well, this year we're celebrating the 75th anniversary of women having the right to vote. And so some of us thought, well, maybe it's time we could at least keep our word to the people who paid for that statue and see if we couldn't bring it up to the second floor where it belongs in the rotunda. I guess they thought there were too many women already in the rotunda. I didn't see any. I mean, it's kind of a guy circle in there. But guess what? When it came to the floor, members on the other side of the aisle said no. And that symbol representing women and the gains they have made in the 75 years got pushed back down in the basement where they still are, if you walk around and see that. Hopefully, we'll finally reach some consensus on it. But that also reflects what's happening to statutes or laws that have been passed by this body. Because many of the statutes that we have worked so hard to get through are being desecrated, they're being pushed back down or pushed out of the law books.
And I appreciate my predecessor here in the well for offering her unique interpretation on events. But as the record will reflect, because I've done some checking specifically about the statue of the suffragettes, that came to the floor as a unanimous consent request, one member, a new addition to this house, the gentle lady from North Carolina, stood in opposition, citing the cost of $80,000 to $100,000. Now, there are those in this body who say, hey, it's no big deal. A little bit of money for a symbol, that's fine. I personally would like to see the statue brought up, but perhaps we ought to find some means of funding to move the statue.
Mr. President, I ask unanimous consent that the Senate now turn to the consideration of S. Conres 21, the Capitol Rotunda, now being held at the desk.
The clerk will report.
Senate concur resolution 21, directing that the portrait monument carved in the likeness of Lucretia Mott, Susan B. Anthony, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, now in the crypt of the Capitol, be restored to its original state and be placed in the Capitol Rotunda.
Mr. President, I send an amendment to the desk and ask that it be considered and agreed to, the concurrent resolution be agreed to, and the motion to reconsider be laid on the table.
Right, so it's a montage of legislative verbiage around the statue that I think is quite funny, actually. I was just wondering if you wanted to comment on any of those clips, Sandra.
Well, I love the brouhaha. That's just, the whole statue's been a brouhaha, the whole story. Well, yes, as was pointed out, there were no statues of women in the rotunda, right? There were no statues. And I also love the idea of connecting statues with statutes. And, you know, getting back to what we were beginning to talk about at the kind of near the beginning of this talk today was about the importance of statues in what they represent, right? And if you can't get statues of women in the rotunda, you know, it's also because you're probably not getting their rights recognized, right, in other ways in the country. And there really is this connection between statues and statutes. And again, looking at why this is being treated differently. For example, people talked about it being ugly. And as someone says throughout this debate somewhere, no one ever talked about whether Abraham Lincoln was ugly or not. And, you know, all these guys that are in here, no one talks about their looks. But as soon as we want to bring a woman in here, then suddenly the idea of looks or beauty comes up. And this is just kind of ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But what else has happened? What these women do that eventually gets the statue moved to the rotunda is that they actually do an engineering study to show that the floor of the rotunda can hold the statue if we don't move the two marble bases with the statue, because those two bases weigh as much as the statue. It weighed 13 tons with the statue plus the bases. So if we leave the marble bases, don't use those. If we put it in the rotunda and put it over where there is good support, certain spots, the engineering study showed that the floor could hold it. Mm-hmm. And of course, as soon as they got past that, then right, another roadblock was put up that, well, who's going to pay for this? And for the first time ever, moving a statue, the people who wanted to move it were asked to actually fund it.
Mm-hmm. And they did.
Yes, and they did. Yes. And they raised over $75,000 to pay for that move.
Mm-hmm. And so it was finally moved in 1997. And so as one of the clips says, I think it's, and by the way, you were listening to Pat Schroeder. She's the one who uses the phrase brouhaha Democrat from Oregon. And she's responded to by J.D. Hayworth, a Republican from Arizona. And then that's Bob Dole, Senator Bob Dole, talking about the unanimous consent request, which was defeated because there was a gentlewoman from North Carolina who said, no, public money should not pay for this. And so it fails, that unanimous consent resolution fails, and it's reintroduced, I think, in 1996 by Ted Stevens, and it's passed, and it's unveiled or like returned to the rotunda in 1997. And as I was working on this show, as you know, Sandra, I found on C-SPAN, I was just shocked, the video of that return. You can watch that. I think I put it on our show resources page, and it's quite, yeah, an elaborate ceremony with, I must add, the POW flag is also in the rotunda when they're
wonderful.
Doing that. Yeah. So there's that. And we're sort of coming to the end. I just want to see if anybody has any further comments, questions about the raising from the crypt. So as of today, the statue is in the rotunda. It's been there since 1997. There was a whole effort behind that. We could have a whole show on that if we wanted. We gave you the very quick version. But yeah, so it was really the 75th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, which spawned, and I should say sparked after Carolyn Sparks, that effort.
I might make one more comment there, just that in accepting it and moving it to the rotunda, it was only stated that only for it to remain in the rotunda for 1 year, which again had never been done before. But of course, it's still there because who would dare move it?
Well, I mean, and this gets to our last part about, this is Black History Month, and we said at the beginning of this show that this statue has been criticized as racist and discriminatory and not telling the whole story of the suffrage movement and the role that African-American women played. And there were protests. So when the statue was returned in 1997, there was opposition to this from African-American women who, and you talk about this in your book, Sandra, who really wanted, you know, you have on the statue, Adelaide Johnson's statue, the unfinished marble, and they wanted to carve Sojourner Truth's image onto that. Because as you said, and as we've said, that this is like, this space is very sacred and there are no Black women in the rotunda. Martin Luther King is in there, but I'm going to play a clip and we'll end with this discussion. This is from the Sojourner Truth Crusade 2002. I think you can access this press conference in its entirety on our show resources page. So here comes the clip.
Let me direct your gaze one last time to the statue itself. I said a moment ago that this is a problem with an unusually simple solution. You notice the large, uninformed slab there behind the three busts. Indeed, on two different occasions during the 1950s, Congress considered adding another bust of Adelaide Johnson, who was a sculptress of this award, this
tribute here. They wanted to put her there, and now they're saying that, oh, that probably was there to include all women. But we know why it was there. And at that time of history, they didn't want a woman in the rotunda, much less a black. And the deal was made, you know, if you don't put her in, we'll give you the 19th Amendment. This project, though never carried out, points to an important truth to be in mind. This statue is not a Michelangelo or Pieta. We are not talking about tampering with the immortal art for the sake of political correctness. This is a composite intended to convey a historical message. The three busts here are replicas of individual busts the artist had created earlier for display elsewhere. As the owner of the statue, the Congress, this was given to the Congress by the National Women's Party, has already taken the liberty of removing the artist's original inscriptions and replacing, for structural reasons, the statue's original heavy marble base. So it's already been tampered with. It is now, though, the right of Congress, and we believe the right thing for Congress, to complete this statue by adding a bust of Sojourner Truth to the vacant spot that seems almost reserved for her. There is no longer any opposition, just the need for congressional action.
That statue as it is today, that stands in the rotunda, is distorted history, is neglected history, is discriminatory history. How ironic, because Sojourner Truth is a true symbol of the suffragist movement. So how can it be that without her? Because she stands as a symbol for all women. Our presence here today is to call attention to that omission, as you see here to my left, and to say that we must alert our churches, our communities, our organizations, the media, and people we come in contact with of the plight of Sojourner Truth.
Right, so those are various clips from this press conference of the Sojourner Truth campaign. The first woman speaking is C. Dolores Tucker, and then after her is Jeanette Houston Harris. So yeah, there's the critique. And on August 26th of this year, I think we've mentioned this on some earlier shows, but in New York, in Central Park, the first statue of real women was erected in commemoration of the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment. And that statue does include Sojourner Truth, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Susan B. Anthony. So Sandra, do you have any comments to, I know you talk about this in your book, but these particular comments, sort of speak to this point that you made earlier about this is like a very important space of our national history, and therefore the statues need to be more representative.
Well, absolutely. And as Dolores Tucker said, this is a problem. It absolutely is a problem. It's been a problem for the entire history of our country, and it is a problem. But while she says there was an easy solution, simply to carve Sojourner Truth into the lump of marble in the back, that really is not an easy solution. I don't think there is an easy solution to this problem. And I guess some of the statements that she makes, unfortunately, are not based in the factual history. A Black woman was not intentionally left out of this. You know, we talked about how Allie Johnson came to think of these three, and that the three busts and this monument were always intended for the rotunda of the Capitol. They were not intended for anywhere else. And her comment about this statue not being immortal art, it wasn't made by Michelangelo or somebody, and it's not immortal art. Well, Adelaide Johnson certainly thought of it as immortal art and uses those words over and over again. And so I find that a little disturbing to say that about the sculptress. But I mean, Dolores Tucker's right. It's absolutely a problem. There has been discrimination in the women's movement, but I think her anger is misdirected in this case. Mm-hmm. That these three women are not oppressors of Black women, mm-hmm. and that there are certainly many other symbols in the Capitol, the statues of Confederates that are in Statuary Hall and throughout the Capitol. These were true oppressors. And so, you know, I think it's misdirected at this statue, which is trying to represent women, which is trying to represent all women, past, present, and future, is trying to represent not only womankind, but humankind and the advancement of the race of humans. I think this is kind of a misdirection. And it turned out that there wasn't room in the marble to actually sculpt a bust into the marble. And that is what stopped this from Sojourner Truth being added to the monument. There's not enough marble there to do it. Mm-hmm. And so the compromise was to make a bust of Sojourner Truth, which ended up being placed in the new visitor center. But really, I'm still disturbed by this problem, in that we still don't have, in 2021, we still don't have a representation of a Black woman or an Asian woman, or, you know, we still do not have adequate representation in the rotunda or in our society, obviously. And so we still have a very big problem to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And anybody else want to go ahead, Randy?
Yeah, I have a number of comments. The first one is that I think that it's blatantly disrespectful to put that interpretation onto the portrait monument, that it's supposed to be of another person. When, I mean, there's a variety of possible interpretations, first of all. And the one that I was, you know, I guess inculcated with was that the final set of marble on the back of the uncarved block that's on the back is symbolically representing the unknown faces of women in history. It's not left there for some other person in the future. It's like deliberately cast that way. So to, you know, at least entertain that theory kind of like, it seems to be missing in our conversation so far.
Absolutely. Yes. I neglected to mention that. You're absolutely right. It was misunderstood. It's kind of an urban legend, right? That the first woman president perhaps was going to be sculpted into that. But that's not at all why Adlai Johnson left that blank. She left it blank to represent the future women who will come along and do the unfinished work that needs to be done. And that was intentionally, as I went through her research, intentionally Adlai Johnson talks about that is part of the background. And if you look at the monument, you see that the unfinished parts of the pedestal just continue right up into that projection. It's all part of the unfinished work.
Thank you. Yeah. So that seems like a more complete interpretation of the work to me than to say that it's, you know, that it's just supposed to be the one more face in order to round out the historical record. It just seems to miss the point. So the second thing I wanted to comment on was something that we've talked about in the show a lot, which is a quote by Andrew Carnegie that's, you know, the mission of the material is to feed the spiritual. And I really, you know, when I look at this monument, I know that it's carrying some kind of moral energy, and we've made that comment a few times now, but it's pulling something into the present. It's pulling in information that we need now into, you know, into this space where we're currently living. And I think that uncarved block, that uncarved portion, or perhaps it's not that it's uncarved. It's like it's left that way in order to tell us something, in order to pull us into the picture and to get here now us involved in carrying the torch, so to speak. And it doesn't just speak to any specific person. I mean, here I am as a male putting myself on that space and recognizing that I have a role to play. And so it's like the fact that it's uncarved has all of that symbolic meaning in it. And I'm personally just shocked at the idea that we're going to put a Band-Aid over it by carving one more face into it and fixing it. And it's just, it's so offensive to me.
I'll just play a little bit of the advocate. we could stay on this, you know, all day. But, you know, going back to Dolores Tucker's point that this is not the pietà. I didn't take that point as a jab against Adelaide Johnson, that she's like not as good as Michelangelo. I took that as a point about this is a piece of work in a public space, and it was made, you know, as a gift to the American people. And so it's not like these other works of art. So for that reason, we have to, you know, look at it. And if we're okay defacing it, like whitewashing the inscription, the argument goes, then we should be okay to change it to, you know, make it more, quote, inclusive. For very intentional reasons, I wanted, you know, Sandra to really get out the story of how this trinity, this trio, really comes from the little head of Susan B. Anthony, right? That's why we get these three. And I also want to say there are some critiques, especially of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and you mentioned, Sandra, that they wanted to remove her, and I think maybe you're getting at the, like, her woman's Bible radicalism and so forth. You know, she says things like, I'm pretty sure it's her that says, you know, how can they let, you know, after the 13th Amendment is passed, there's a lot of anger on the part of Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton that Black men have gotten the right to vote, and they were part of the movement, and women have been left behind. And Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton start, you know, their own organization, where Lucy Stone and Julia Ward Howe say it's good, like, let them have it, we'll keep working for us. And so there's this real, like, hurt and pain that's processed in different ways. And you have Elizabeth Cady Stanton saying things like, how could they let, you know, these ignorant people vote when you have, you know, like, white women who are educated and they can't vote, which is arguably a kind of, you know, racist thing to say. And so these are remarks that historians have seized on to say that, you know, the suffragists were quote racists. As we, I think we pointed out, well, it's not that easy because they also worked on behalf of abolition. But as some historians have said, just because you're fighting for the end of slavery doesn't mean you're pro-equality. So there's that. There's a lot going on. And I think, you know, one of the things that's done by the statue, as you pointed out, Randy, is, you know, it's like pulling this information into the present that needs to, that we need. And part of this is like this bit that we're talking about now. And I take, you know, that to be a kind of like lesson, the Sojourner Truth campaign, and sort of making me more mindful about, okay, there's this other piece that we have to learn that I quite frankly don't know enough about. So I'll stop talking and see if anybody else wants to jump in. And we're going to, you know, wind things down now because we've been going for about 90 minutes.
Yes, we could. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, thank you. No, I was just going to throw in, I guess, my two cents and go off of what Randy said of, you know, the statue is pulling something into a present. I think the impact of the statue also comes around that all of these points that we've brought up in this conversation in general is important. It's very relevant, and it touches on a lot of the issues that still plague our society today. And so for it to be a catalyst of conversation and of organization of work is also, I think personally, what gives the statue greater resonance of being a thing through which individuals can discuss and see the past and also look towards building a better future.
Sandra, do you want to?
That's wonderful. You know, yeah, I forgot what I was going to say. Oh, that we could talk all day, I think, about, you know, the 1860s and what happened there. And with, you know, women not getting the vote and Black men getting the vote. And really, there's such controversy. And I'm pulling that into today. And we're still talking about those same issues today. And I think perhaps, you know, one of the lessons here is that, you know, at that time, so Black men were sort of pitted against women, white women, perhaps you want to say, and Black women were like kind of caught in the middle or pushed to the side. And we continue to have these discussions today. And I think, you know, we have to realize sometimes the bigger issue that we're working for. And why are we, in a sense, I feel like being pitted against each other? Instead, we should be joining hands and working to fight white supremacy, right? And other things that tend to divide us rather than bring us together.
Yeah. Well said. To quote Carmelo Soprano from The Sopranos, she says something like, why are we, like, what is this addiction to blame? I love that. And I'll be the first one to just say my final piece, and then we'll go around and this really important conversation again on Black History Month. And that's why I brought up the Sojourner Truth campaign. So right, Sandra, I'll quote Hamsa Khan, who says, put your sword down and think hard. And my sort of gloss on that is, instead of blame, reflect. And, you know, that reflection involves learning history. Like, we're not born with innate knowledge of this. And so it takes a long time to come up to speed with what has happened and how we got here. And I think that's part of reflection, is learning history. I think that, you know, the statue sort of points us to all of these different stories from 100 years ago, but also brings us up into the present when it's raised from the crypt and all of these other issues are discussed in connection with it. So this is still happening. As we know, the Capitol has been very much in the news, and there's talks about it being less accessible to people. And so these stories remain extremely important, and this history of our country and a sort of broader view of the history is what we try to do. So I'll stop there and just say again, put your sword down and think hard, and instead of blame, reflect. And then we'll start with Michael, go to Randy, and then Sandra will have the last word.
I'll just close out by extending a huge thank you to you, Sandra, for this incredible work. Even you putting out this creative endeavor of injecting your book into the consciousness of existence and all the pieces that had to be put together and the documents and the thousands of pages, that is a huge effort. And I think by people coming to know this history, as we've discussed during this almost 2 hours now with amongst each other, that this is a very relevant, that the Portrait Monument is a very relevant subject, and that it serves as a conduit through what so many issues in our modern times are being played out through. And I think to focus on that, and like Hope said, to get caught up to speed on the history is something really important. So I thank you, Sandra, for contributing to that wider consciousness and putting out this truly incredible work. It's been a pleasure getting to meet you and talk with you.
Thank you. My last words.
Well, so.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's not my turn yet.
Oh, you're welcome to take my turn.
No, go ahead, please.
I'll just say that I think that covering up the inscription would make for a very interesting, like, literary comparison with what happens in Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray. I think that there's some striking similarities there, and for anyone who's keen on that kind of investigation, they'd probably be amused by that book and reading it alongside yours.
Interesting idea. It was my pleasure to spend so much time studying this statue and discovering so much history that I didn't know, and better understanding the meaning in this piece of sculpture. And I had, you know, when I started, I had no idea where it was going to take me. And it took me to a place that I felt like prepared me for the next 5 years that we've all lived through. And I've often looked to the statue to try to make sense of what we're actually living through. And Adlai Johnson's one main message in this statue was a rising woman. And I think of myself as one of these arising women, and really we don't even have to say women, arising people, and that we are all trapped in this block around us of obstacles and oppressions and prejudices that keep us from rising perhaps to our full potential. And so I realize that I'm in that statue, that I'm still learning, I'm still rising up, trying to be the best that I can be, and to look to the future and try to help the next generation who's going to come along, and try for them to rise up higher out of that block.
That's beautifully put. And we will end it there. You have been listening to a very special episode on the 100th anniversary of the unveiling of Adlai Johnson's woman suffrage statue, or the portrait monument. It has various names. Sandra Weber, who is the foremost expert on the statue, has been joining us for now 2 weeks. Today is also Susan B. Anthony's birthday. So with that, I wish you all Godspeed, and thank you so much for spending time on this important topic. Goodbye.